Today's Teisha will be on case 25 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pyen Lu, the pure, the Guru Rock collection. Case 25 is as follows. It's entitled The Master of Rengyo's Staff. Rengyo's introduction. If the action of one's ki is not independent of one's degree of enlightenment, one falls into a sea of poison. If one's words do not astonish the crowd, one slips into the conventional. If you can distinguish black from white in the moment of a spark's being struck, and can tell life from death in the instant of a flash of lightning, then you will be able to command all quarters and stand firm like a 1,000-foot cliff. Who could ever be so? See the following. Main subject. The master of Rengyo's cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? No one could answer, and he replied for them, because it is no use in the course of life. And again he replied, after all, what will you do with it? And once again he said in their stead, taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulders, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. Sitcho's verse, his eyes filled with sand, his ears with clay. Even among the 1,000 mountains, he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. Open your eyes wide, and you'll wonder where he's gone. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning and practicing with such diligence and open-heartedness. It's really wonderful to see people willing to do this. And this morning we had quite a large number of people all sitting absolutely still for an hour and a half. That's very challenging. A number of years ago, Lenore and Earl went to a Japanese temple. And they asked if they could sit in the temple. And the abbot of the temple said, well, I'm not sure you're ready to sit here. And he said, how long at your place, at your Zen center, how long do they sit? Half an hour? And they went, they shook their head no. He said, an hour? They shook their head no. Then he said, an hour and a half? And they shook their head yes. And he said, come in. So very impressed by the quality of our sitting. See. So, you know, many people sit for 15 or 20 minutes, and we definitely have visitors who come to our group, and they're a little bit astonished by how long we sit. But it's extremely important to practice this way. You know, as I've mentioned, you know, if you meditate for 15 minutes, that's a noble commitment of your time. And it's much to be applauded. But on the other hand, you know, after 15 minutes, you're just beginning to relax. And after, you know, say 25 or 30 minutes, your mind is just, you're just beginning to be able to do real meditation. That is, to step beyond your thoughts or to work around your thoughts and enter kind of empty space. So most people stop after half an hour, so they just kind of get there, and then they go up and go to work, go to sleep, whatever. So, you know, that kind of a longer sit, half hour, hour, hour and a half, is really crucial. But then, you know, the sesshin is this wonderful opportunity to really, really deeply engage with what Zen calls this matter of awakening. And it's absolutely, sashin is absolutely indispensable. And this kind of sitting for many, many hours a day is so purifying body, mind, and heart. And at the end of this period, if it's a weekend or if it's the 5 days, you'll notice that, you know, when you get up in the morning, if you go outside, you'll notice how fresh and clear everything is and how alive everything is. So I really thank you for making such a wonderful effort. So this koan is really, really important koan. The master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a person reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? No one could answer, and he replied for them, because it is no use in the course of life. So, you know, when we come to Zen, or when we come to Buddhism of any kind, you know, we're usually struggling with something, some kind of unhappiness or life situation that's unsatisfactory, or we feel that something's missing in our lives, you know. And often when we sit down on the cushion, you know, we're looking for peace and stillness. And we get that peace and stillness for a while, you know. So beginners who start to meditate, they breathe, they sit properly with a straight back, they're breathing through the dantian, through the hara, the lower abdomen. They're watching the breath, and they begin to notice after about 15 or 20 minutes this wonderful relaxation response. And that is so beautiful. You know, many people are unable ever to have that kind of stillness, that kind of focus and attentiveness, and then to enter that sort of deep relaxation. It's really wonderful. But you know, if you persist just a little bit beyond this, you begin to notice that stillness and clarity begins to go away, and what replaces it is kind of like a jumble of thoughts and emotions. So, you know, beginners may enjoy moments of real peace and stillness, but if they continue to practice, they're going to have this jumble of stuff come out. You know, first of all, right below the surface of your conscious mind, there's a kind of stream of consciousness flowing all the time. So, you know, when you start meditating, you're beginning to put the conscious mind on the back burner. You know, you'll be thinking when you come in to meditate, tomorrow I have to get that report drafted from my boss, right? And you're thinking about the presentation you'll have to make at the end of the week and so on. You sit down on the cushion and you push that away and you just watch the breath, and suddenly you become serene, right? And that's moving from the first level of consciousness toward the second level of consciousness. But when you get to the second level of consciousness, you'll notice that your mind has now become busy again, that there's like this rushing torrent of thoughts, and they're not necessarily coherent thoughts, like on Thursday I have to have this report. They're more like fragments of thoughts or images, and along with those sometimes emotions. So, you know, you're sitting there, you're watching your breath, and these pieces of thoughts are drifting through your head. And at times you'll feel an emotion. You'll suddenly feel sorrow, or you'll feel loss, or you'll feel anger or something like that. You won't quite know why. And now this is really crucial to be at this level, because this is where we begin to go into an even deeper state. We begin to move down into the layers of the mind. And if you persist in watching the breath, you'll eventually get below that level. There's a level where there are very few thoughts and you're more aware of your environment. And then you go below that, and finally you're just focused on nothing but the breath. And much of the rest has just disappeared. And then you know, you're watching the breath, and eventually your mind becomes blank. As I've said, you know, that's not enlightenment, but that's the begin. That's a very deep state, that state of emptiness, shunyata, very, very deep. You know, a lot of preliminary practice involves moving up and down those layers of the mind. So, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you start watching the breath and you begin to feel a sense of relaxation. And then all of a sudden, something hits you, you know, you're reminded of something that you wanted to leave behind. So possibly you're thinking about a conflict at work. Maybe you have to work with this person who has not been polite to you, you know, or affirmative, or maybe this person has betrayed you in some way. And you think about how this person hurt your feelings or was not straightforward with you, and you can feel your anxiety rising, right? Or maybe you've made a mistake. You know, you're sitting on the cushion, you're watching the breath, you begin to grow calm, and then you realize, you know, it was a big mistake for you to do such and such, right? And then you feel remorse, then you get down on yourself and so on. You know, this is an essential part of meditation practice. Many people think that when this happens, it's a distraction from the practice, that this is getting them off track or something like that. But actually, this is really crucial for your practice. You know, basically, this is like working through your karma. You know? And some of it is hard work to get through. You know, sometimes we don't want to look at this stuff. We're avoiding confronting it. So if we're working with a koan can help us by bringing to the surface something we haven't wanted to confront and work through. So let's say you're working with the two monks roll up a blind. A master comes into the zendo, the zen hall, and he wants to give a talk just like this. But it's too dark for him to read his notes. So he says, please roll up the blinds. And two monks jump up. According to the koan, two monks jump up. At the same time, they go over to the blinds. And these are draw blinds where you pull a string and they roll up. They're like bamboo, rice paper and bamboo draw blinds, right? So he pulls the, both monks grab the string at the same time and pull the curtain, window coverings up. And the master looks at monk one and he says, you hit the target. And he looks at monk number two and he says, you didn't hit the target. See? So he says, one hit, one miss. And the koan is one hit, one miss. So look, two identical monks get up. They both roll up the blinds at the same time. You know, they're roughly the same height. They're roughly the same age. They do the same thing. And the master says, you've got it and you don't have it. So one hit, one miss. And you sit down on the cushion and you say, one hit, one miss, one hit, one miss. See, that's how koans work. And that's like an unconscious cue. It's sinking down into your unconscious mind, and it's beginning to percolate. So, you know, it goes into your unconscious, and then it begins to bring things to the surface that you might not have wanted to deal with. So, you know, maybe as you're working with the koan, at first you're thinking you're making good progress. You're entering deep samadhi. You feel very still. You feel very calm. All good. And then, you know, basically, you begin to feel anger or a sense of disappointment. And you don't know why. You can't really say why this is happening. And it becomes a powerful emotional response to the koan. And you keep sitting, and little by little, maybe you remember, you know, maybe your brother and you were competitors for your parents' love. And maybe your brother often received the praise that you desperately wanted, right? And now you remember that. First, often it's first in a vague emotion, and then, you know, this comes up. And then you feel, you feel sadness, or you feel anger or outrage or whatever, and you're overwhelmed maybe. Sometimes this happens. You know, this is the difficulty of working with a koan. But gradually, you know, those powerful emotions begin to go away, and you begin to become clear. It's like dirty water, muddy water, has begun to settle out. All the mud has gone to the bottom. And the water has become clear, beautiful, sparkling. And that's kind of how you feel at the end of the process. You feel clear and clean and sparkling, right? You know, this is like purifying body, mind, and heart. So, you know, this is a very, very important and liberating process. No matter what problems we bring to the cushion, even the problems we have wanted to escape from, you know, they come up on the cushion sooner or later. And when they do, we don't welcome them because we want peace and stillness and so on. We want to be the happy monk in the picture, or the happy Buddhist in the picture, smiling and totally at ease in the world. And we will become that person. But not right now. You know, right now we need to work through our obstacles. So, you know, a lot of Zen practice involves moving from that stillness and that peace into, like, confrontation with our obstacles. And if we're unwilling to do that, we can't make much progress. So people who cling to stillness and cling to peace are actually headed for disaster, because, of course, things are going to knock you off balance. Okay, so then you practice, and you go through koan after koan after koan, and it's a strenuous, difficult process in some ways, right? Because, you know, you're struggling to answer these koans. They're addressing issues that are complicated and hard to resolve in yourself. And finally, you get through all your koans, and you go in one day and you have daikensho. And if you practice long enough, that will happen to you. But, you know, then you have daikensho and you say, okay, you know, I'm free of illusion. I'm free of illusion. You know, how wonderful. And you set off into the world. And the first person you run into is your neighbor who's walking his dog. And you look at your neighbor walking his dog, and you notice that he has let his dog pin your cat to the telephone pole. You know, the cat has retreated to the telephone pole and its hair is standing up. And you feel terrified for your beloved cat, and you're mad at this guy for letting his dog push the cat up against the telephone pole instead of pulling the leash and letting the cat go by unmolested. So, you know, basically you breathe, you focus. And then you have to do something, you have to act. So maybe you act and you say, hey, I want you to restrain your dog. Okay? That you're frightening my cat. That's not acceptable. Okay, that's answer number one. Answer number two is you say, my brother, you know, think of the poor cat, you know, frightened and alone. And helpless compared to your giant German shepherd. Have some compassion. Okay, next one. You see the cat up against the telephone pole. You're frightened for your beloved cat. You run over and turn on the tap to the garden hose and you spray the man and the dog with a garden hose. Okay. See, those are your three options. Okay. Which do you pick? Right? Which does the enlightened person pick? See. Option number one, firm laying down of the law. No, don't do this again. Number two, compassionate request. Number three, garden hose. Right. Okay. So you pick number two. You decide to be a sweet person and you say, brother, you know, aren't we all sentient beings? Don't we all, as the Buddha says, don't we all fear death? You know, I try to respect all sentient beings. I'm asking you to do the same. Okay. Next day, you see the guy coming down the street. He's got his dog, and the dog goes after your cat. And the cat's pinned against the telephone pole. So that approach didn't work. Okay. So next approach, you say to the guy, that's unacceptable, right? And I don't ever want to see that again. That's the first approach, okay? Next day, you get your new tax bill, and it turns out this guy is in charge of the city treasury, and he's raised your tax bill by $2,000, okay? That's the next thing. Third one, garden hose. Okay, so, you know, you turn on the garden hose, you spray him, you spray the dog, and that'll teach him. And the next thing you know, a cop drives up, and you're arrested for assault with a watering device or something. Okay, and now you have to go downtown, and they book you for assault with a weapon. What's the right response? What would an enlightened? What would the Buddha do? Right? What would the Buddha do? So you know what we want to say is that once we're fully awake, we'll know what the Buddha would do. We'll know what the Buddha would do. And we won't make any mistakes. And this is so comforting, right? We don't want to make mistakes. You know, we figure there must be a right answer. Somebody would do it right. See, somebody would be the adult in the room, right? Somebody would do it right. And we figure, you know, if we just do enough meditation, we'll know what to do. We won't make any mistakes. You know, but actually, if you look at the Buddha's own life, it's possible to argue that the Buddha made mistakes. The Buddha made mistakes. You know, so the Buddha's best friend, King Bimbisara, was murdered by his own son when he wouldn't step aside. Ajatashatru killed his father. Now, you know, the Buddha had a lot to do with teaching Bimbisara's son. Right? It had a lot to do with the education of Bimbisara's son. You know, and it's probably the case that, you know, the Buddha must have wondered, where did I go wrong? You know, this guy killed his father. Also, you know, after Ajatashatru killed his father, the Buddha did not like lead a rebellion to overthrow him, right? He continued to associate with Bimbisara's son and did not condemn him in public and so on. Maybe that was a mistake. Maybe it wasn't a mistake because, you know, if the Buddha had condemned Ajatashatru, you know, basically that might have been the end of the Sangha, you know, and the Buddha himself, you know. I mean, if you criticize a dictator, you know, what is going to happen to you, right? What is going to happen to your followers? There was a very famous Japanese Zen master, lay Zen master named Senno Rikyu. He invented the tea ceremony. And Senno Rikyu had like a, a long battle with the Emperor of Japan, like a struggle. He was the Emperor of Japan's spiritual teacher, but he was also very critical of the Emperor of Japan and for his warlike ways, you could say. And eventually, he went too far, and the Emperor of Japan ordered him to commit suicide. And he did. So you know, basically, when you're dealing with emperors, now look, should Rikyu have avoided committing suicide? Should he have challenged the emperor? What's the right way, and what's the wrong way? So we're looking for the right answer. We're looking for the right thing to do. And we're thinking a Buddha would know. The Buddha would know what to do. And what would the Buddha do? See. But you know, I don't think that's what the Dharma is all about. I don't think that's what the Dharma is all about. In fact, I think it's unrealistic, and it's not full realization to believe that there's a right answer, to believe that there's a right answer. You know, so if you have a child, you know, my sister has an older son who has always been difficult. He's the kind of kid who will push your buttons. You know, so my sister and I were coming back. We all went kayaking while my sister was visiting. I took them all up to the Delaware around Easton, and we took a lovely river ride in kayaks down the river. And the whole time, my nephew was trying to make the trip unpleasant. He was refusing to row, you know, the kayak. He was complaining the whole time. He was trying to ruin the trip. And on the way home, I kept trying to talk to my sister, and he kept interrupting. He likes to eat at a Mexican restaurant called Moe's, which is like this, in my opinion, inauthentic Mexican restaurant. And he would just start talking about Moe's in the middle of our conversation. He'd be like, "Can we eat at Moe's?" He says, "Boy, I love Moe's." And we're trying to have this deep conversation, you know. And I finally told him, I said, "Listen, don't interrupt. You know, this is your mother and I'm your uncle, and you have to have some manners." What would the Buddha have done? Would he have turned and said, "Young man, you know, don't you think it's so rare that I have a chance to talk to your mother, my beloved sister? You know, please be mindful of my needs, right? You know, there are three or four different options that we could, since there isn't a water hose in the car, I couldn't have hosed him down though I wanted to." So what's the right answer? See, we think there's a right answer. We think if we just were enlightened, we'd know what to do. See, if I were just fully enlightened, I'd know what to do. And then, you know, we're in a quandary. You know, we've been practicing for 30 years, and we do something, and we realize in retrospect, "Oh, that was such a mistake. Why did I do that? What a stupid mistake." And you could say, "Oh, this Zen, this is a waste of time, because I've been practicing Zen, and I'm still making mistakes. See, I'm still making mistakes after 30 years of Zen practice. This is a scam. This is a fraud. If only I practiced well, I would have the right answer." See, that's what we think. And this is a very alluring way of thinking. Because when we feel like we're confused and we're in doubt and we don't know what to do, we want to believe that somewhere someone knows the right answer, that there is a right answer. And, you know, this goes back to our early childhood when, you know, we would ask our parents, if we did something wrong, our parents would admonish us. And if we did something right, they would reward us and pat us on the head and say, "You're a good boy, here, have a candy," right? So, you know, we're looking at the world as though we're little children, and we're asking the world to pat us on the head when we find the right answer. We're asking, like, the Buddha to help us get the head pat, see? You know, this is really a illusion. It's illusion. You know, there is no formula for correct action in a constantly changing universe, see? There's no formula for correct action. We look back at our mistakes and we say, oh my God, why did I do that? Why didn't I see that? You know, why didn't I see that? But that's not in the nature of our existence. No human being can predict the future. It's not written yet. It's still emergent, see? So, you know, we might be disappointed when our Zazen didn't teach us to look out for whatever blindsided us. But we couldn't have known, and it's not mature, it's immature, it's like childish, to believe that someone somewhere knows what you should have done. See, and the Buddha didn't say that. See, even the Buddha made quote-unquote mistakes. You know, when the Dalai Lama fled Tibet, the American CIA came to him and said, we would like to fund a guerrilla movement in Tibet to overthrow the Chinese. And the Dalai Lama said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. And he got involved with the CIA, and and all the people who fought in that guerrilla outfit were killed. It was like a totally crazy plan that got everybody killed. So you could say the Dalai Lama made a mistake. The Dalai Lama made a mistake. And it was a bad mistake. People got killed. But you know, I'm not trying to defend the Dalai Lama. I'm just saying, you know, it's immature to think that we can live without making quote unquote mistakes, which is our word for acting without total information, which nobody has. So look. You know, in Zen literature, you'll read book after book where the Zen master says something like, my life, the Zen master's final poem will be something like, my life, one big mistake. And you'll see this in Zen literature. A Zen teacher will say, the poem he writes at the end of his life is, my life, one big mistake, or mistake after mistake. See, there's a very famous Rinzai teacher who has a book called From Novice to Master, and the subtitle is something like a History of My Own Stupidity, right? My own stupidity. And we think, oh, okay, the novice is stupid, but the master is no longer stupid. But that's not true. The master also makes stupid mistakes. Master also makes mistakes. That's our word. Okay. When the master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his, the master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, in olden times, when a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? It takes courage. It takes integrity. It takes awakened mind to make mistakes, if that makes any sense. Look, the easiest thing in life is to avoid mistakes, right? The easiest thing in life is to avoid mistakes. Just do what everybody else is doing. But you know, when you make mistakes, it means you had the courage to do something. It means you had the trust in life to do something. I hope this is making some sense, because this is so important. You know, making mistakes is a sign of your trust in life. It's a sign of your wisdom and courage. When you beat yourself up, when you rebuke yourself because you, quote, made a mistake, that's not wisdom. That's confusion. You know, the Buddha tried three times to keep an invading army from destroying his country. You know, neighboring country, Kosala, was coming over to invade the Shakya Republic, the Buddha's homeland, because of a grievance they had with the Buddha's people. The first time the army came, the Buddha stopped them. He went to the bridge separating the two states, and he said to the general, who was actually respected the Buddha, he said, "Don't you see this is the path of unhappiness for everyone? Now please go home." And the general thought it over, and he went home. Second time, Buddha goes out and says, "Please stop, don't do this." General thought it over and went home. Third time, okay. Fourth time, the Buddha was busy, you know, was doing something else. He was far away. And they came in and wiped out the Shakya Republic. So, you know, the Buddha was away. You know, he made a mistake. But, you know, the thing is, he tried to deal with the situation. He had the courage and the trust to try to deal with the situation. We can't control results. See, we have no control over the results of what we do. We have no control. We wish we had control, but we don't. So, you know, you could do something that's very good for a good reason, and the unfolding of events could look like a disaster. And in retrospect, you say, "Oh my God, how could I have been so blind?" But you see, you know, results, this sounds very strange to say, but we really aren't responsible for the results. What we're responsible for is doing our best and having the trust and the clarity to act in the world. An enlightened person with a clear mind can act in the world, and it can be the quote unquote wrong action. The results of the action may not conform to what we expected to have happen. See? So in retrospect, we can say, "Oh, that person wasn't really enlightened, or he would have known what to do." But you see, the world is a complicated place, and things unfold in complicated ways. We don't have all the information. Even Buddhas don't have all the information. So when we're in a quandary, when we're in a contradiction or a difficult situation, see, what we really need to have is that empty mind, open heart, and trust. And you do your best. The failure to act, the failure to take responsibility, that's a failure. Failing to act, choosing not to take responsibility, that's a failure. So, you know, you're walking down the street and you see three 15-year-olds punching a 8-year-old. Walking by is a failure. That's a failure. I would say you have a moral obligation to intervene. But how you intervene, you know, who knows? But if you say, "Okay, I'm going to act from a place that's not motivated by hatred or fear," and you do your best, you've done your best. See, what's a failure, so to speak, is being too afraid and untrusting to take a chance on acting in the world. And if we act in the world, we're going to make mistakes. You know, if you raise kids, you're going to make countless mistakes. But you know what? Who knows what the right, there is no right way. If you do this, they become like this. If you do that, they become like that. You know, so look, intentionality, purifying body, mind, and heart, so that when we act, we're acting with love and kindness towards others is the most important thing. And if we're acting from that place, and we can only act from that place, actually, if we've done a lot of zazen, right? I mean, often action is paralyzing. You know, when we go into deep mushin and we work through our obstacles, we have a kind of Zen spontaneity that comes from trusting life. But trusting life doesn't mean life is always going to do what we want it to do. It means we're going to live in trust, knowing that there's a lot that's unpredictable. Right? We're going to act even though life is unpredictable. If you're acting from a place that's like loving kindness and trust, you're doing everything you can as a human being. That's like A+. That's the A+ grade. Okay. The master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, "When in olden time a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there?" In other words, you know, why do enlightened people get embroiled in all this confusion? No one could answer. And he replied, "Because it is of no use in the course of life." What he means is there is no confusion. There's just an opportunity to deepen our awareness. But that involves, quote unquote, making mistakes. And again, he asked, after all, what will you do with it? What good is enlightenment if you don't use it to make mistakes? That's what enlightenment is for. And again, he asked, after all, what will you do with it? And once again, he said in their stead, they still can't answer. Taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulders, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses and the 100,000 mountains. So striding through life with an open heart, that's what the practice is all about. You know, it won't necessarily make you a successful stock trader, right? But you're still acting from the right place. And no matter what happens, right, the practice is about living in trust, living in loving kindness. Sencho's verse, his eyes filled with sand, his ears with clay. Even among the thousands of mountains, he does not remain. See, life blows sand in your eyes. Life puts, you know, gets the clay stuck in your eardrum, right? But even so, he keeps going, right? He trusts in life. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. In other words, he doesn't hold on to anything. He doesn't obsess over his mistakes. Open your eyes wide and you'll wonder where he's gone.